Welcome to Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast. Today's episode, we will be talking about the film Number 17. My name is Tom Caldwell.
I'm Chris Haig.
I'm Brandon Shamitella.
And we will be your three gentlemen hosts for this evening. Welcome back, guys. We just are kind of getting going for the fall season here. We had a lazy summer. We didn't do a lot of shows, but it's great to be back with both of you on the airwaves talking about Alfred Hitchcock. And without any further ado, let's throw things over to Chris for the synopsis of this film.
Okay. So, this is Number 17. This is a 1932 film by Hitchcock. The synopsis from the Hitchcock Zone is very short. So I will read that, and then I'll combine a little bit of the other one, the only other one I managed to find, which is on Wikipedia. So, Number 17. Detective Gilbert is searching for a necklace robbed by a gang of thieves. In the beginning, the gang is in a house in London. Then they are running away from police. It will not be easy for the detective to recover the jewel. That is the worst synopsis. I'm really sorry for that. That sounds so boring.
It's about accurate.
Yeah, but it's not like enticing. It's not like, oh, what will they find? It's like, no, it won't be hard for him, or it won't be difficult. Or like, I'm just like, no. I'm just looking at the plot synopsis and I'm like, that's really long. I know it is, it's like so long and it's quite a confusing film. Detective Barton is searching for a necklace stolen by a gang of thieves. The gang is in a house in London before going on the run. Upon exploring the house, they find Detective Barton, under the guise of Forsyth, discovers a dead body. And ensuing, he finds handcuffs, he finds a person crawling on the roof, who then falls to the floor, named Miss Ackroyd. Three people arrive at the windswept house: Mr. Ackroyd, Nora, who is deaf-mute, and a third person. Hijinks ensue.
I missed that part.
Culminating in revelations about the robbers, including the revelation that Nora is indeed neither deaf nor mute. The three robbers attempt to get away by a train, escaping onto a fictional London or UK to German ferry expressway. Forcing Detective Barton / Forsyth to give chase to rescue Nora and the jewels. Yeah, that I literally just made up that summary on the spot, so please forgive me, but it's kind of a confusing film.
Yeah, this is kind of an interesting film as well. I mean, it's only 65 minutes long, which is also kind of interesting.
Yeah, it's lean, so it has that going for it. There's not a lot of, like, kind of filler on it, but it's like, it's a bit confusing.
Yeah.
Well, even one of our Twitter followers, Manish, who was on one of our earlier episodes,
oh, Manny.
His comment, oh God, this movie. It'll be fun to hear you try to make sense of the plot.
Yeah.
Thanks for the confidence.
Challenge quickly, accepted.
One other quick viewer mail on Twitter from Mike Baker. First half was dreadfully dull. He didn't know what was going on, didn't care. It was a Cockney stereotype in the picture far too often, and then Hitch gets his toy train set out for the last act, and suddenly it gets much better.
Mm-hmm.
We appreciate the cards and letters from all the viewers out there in television land.
Yep, thank you very much.
Yes, excellent. Now, before we break down the film, let's do a little bit on the trivia of the film. I don't have very much as well, just like on my last movie here. Number 17 is from 1932, directed by Hitchcock, based on the stage play by J. Jefferson Farjon. I hope I'm saying that
Farjon.
Right.
Farjon? I've read a few of the books, so yeah.
Okay.
Farjon.
Wikipedia lists the release date as the 18th of July, 1932, in London. And for actors in this, so Leon M. Lyon played Ben. He was a British stage and film actor, playwright, theatrical manager, and producer. And Lyon produced and appeared in a number of plays written by John Galsworthy, and their correspondence was later published as a book. Lyon toured in the play version of Number 17 in the late 20s, and this was his only Hitchcock appearance in this film version of Number 17. Anne Gray played Nora, and she was born Eileen Ewing. She was a popular brown-eyed, brown-haired leading lady of early British talking films who often played gentle sophisticates. She moved to Hollywood with her husband and actor Lester Matthews in 1935 with only a modicum of success. She returned to England and retired by the end of the decade. This was also her only Hitchcock appearance. Donald Calthrop played Brant. He was a British, an English film actor. He appeared in 63 films between 1916 and 1941, including 5 directed by Hitchcock. He was also in Blackmail, Juno and the Paycock, Elstree Calling, and Murder. John Stewart was born John Alfred Loudon Crowell, and he was a Scottish actor and very popular leading man in British silent films of the 20s. He was born in Edinburgh. I remember Edinburgh. That's right. His first talkie was called Kitty in 1929, and it was very successful. His last role was in the film Superman as the Kryptonian Elder. And he was buried in Brompton Cemetery in London. And this he was also in Elstree Calling, though not the Hitchcock segment, but he was also in The Pleasure Garden by Hitchcock. And so that's all that I've got for this film.
Right.
What did you guys think? Like, was it a challenging film to watch? Did you have trouble following what was going on, or was that just me watching after midnight and not paying attention?
No, it's not just you. It's a very... for me personally, and you guys, I want to hear what you guys think as well, but for me, it was just a very confusing film, but it sort of made... basically the guy who did the original, because it was originally the book by J. Jefferson Farjan, I've read some of his stuff before, and it's very similar in the sense of there's usually a protagonist who gets dropped in, and there's like a confusing plot that has to get resolved and a race against time and that sort of thing, and it's fine. It's very similar to books of his, like Seven Dead and 13 Guests and Mystery in White and all that sort of thing, but they're more murder mysteries, whereas this is much more of like a straight up kind of crime thriller. I didn't mind it, I was disappointed by it. I really wish it could have just been a lot more coherent. They didn't need to be so kind of faithful to the plot, I guess. There are times when if you're going to adapt a book, literally adapt it straight into film, where it's not going to work as a film. And I think this was a lot like that, because there was just too much going on. It wasn't... If they were going to do that, then it needed to be longer to separate everyone out, because like, I kept getting confused between characters. So like Nora and Rose Aykroyd, I was like, I kept confusing them. Partially because, let's face it, in 1930s, a lot of the actresses looked incredibly similar. You know, they were all white, they were all slim, they were all, you know, dark-haired and all that sort of thing.
So it was a challenging film to follow. The first half really is very straightforward, kind of blasé. I got off onto a different tangent and started looking at the tropes in the film, the typical Hitchcock touches, like brandy. There's brandy everywhere. And how do you use brandy to wake people up? I'm pretty sure it has the opposite effect. There's a lot of people passing out and getting woken with brandy. And he loves his staircases and his shadows. And yes, there's a lot of tight shots of hands and fingers coming through mailboxes and things like that. So we're seeing a lot of that classic Hitchcock cinematography, which develops later on. And it's stylistically an interesting film to watch. But Yeah, the story was a challenge.
See, when I was watching this film, like, it was kind of boring, but it was kind of not boring. Like, it was an interesting idea, but it was just not a very believable story, okay? So this person's investigating something weird that's going on in this apartment, and, you know, these people are coming by who are the criminals because they're trying to find something in the apartment, and they go through this escape, and it was interesting, but it was not believable because, you know, when that one guy, Ben, was passed out in the bathroom, quote-unquote passed out in the bathroom, you know, and he was, like, you know, squinting his eyes real hard, like this is how my three-year-old acts when they're trying to play hide and seek with me and they can't see, you know, like it was completely unbelievable that this criminal was peeking down at him and not realizing that he was awake and moving, you know, but the train sequence really did redeem the film.
Yeah.
You know, and I thought the train sequence was pretty exciting and really quite interesting. So I'm kind of torn. And I mean, like, I'm kind of glad that it was short because, you know, it was, I don't know, it was a weird film.
Yeah.
Now, there was a truck on the highway chasing the train.
Yes.
And was that really obvious that these were models, or was that just our modern eye? Like, back in the day, would they have been, hey, that's convincing? Or did it just look cheesy?
I don't know, because I can pick out in modern effects, I can see what's, like, not real and, you know, with CG and stuff like that. So I'm guessing that people would have known that it was a model at the time. But I don't know. Like, it was an exciting sequence, but it was all that the movie had going for it was this train sequence, you know?
Yeah.
And that again becomes a real theme that Hitchcock loves his trains and his train stories and the... Okay. It was an interesting part of the film, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It definitely elevated. And weirdly, I'd seen it out of context before, the whole train. And because there was one of those, you know, Hitchcock interview documentary things where he talks about, I use models for this. I didn't realise until I watched it. And I was like, oh, shit, I already know that. I already know that from this documentary or whatever. But no, I thought it was done very well in regards to, you know, whether or not people would have known. Maybe? I mean, because let's be right, when CGI first started getting used, I'm sure there have been plenty of people going, well, how the hell did they do that? How did they start, you know, computer effects and all that sort of thing? When they started becoming kind of unnoticeable, when they started becoming so good that people were kind of going like, wow, that is one hell of a practical effect, or that is, you know, that sort of thing. But I suppose it depends how much historically miniatures were used at that point, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly.
But no, I really enjoyed the sequence. What annoys me more is I would genuinely love to see someone try and tackle this now, because I think there is actually a kind of an interesting, good little caper in there, like a little thriller,
right?
And it is quite a light story, you know. I know people dying and all that sort of thing, but it's done very bloodlessly. You know, there is a romance at the end. The very ending where she says, "Come on, we're going," and she says, "You know, to where?" And he says, "To breakfast," and they laugh and that sort of thing. You know, it is light. It is a Sunday tea time kind of film. You know, it's, you know, very light and everything, and I really would like to see someone do that. And I'd love to see someone do the train sequence kind of practically. Because it'd be very easy to, like, CGI it all, and I'm like, well, you could, and it'd look all right, but, you know, the practical effects would be a real nice kind of callback to Hitchcock. It was just, you know, like you guys said, very weird film. It did remind me a bit, it was almost like a much lighter kind of precursor to, like, the 1934 Man Who Knew Too Much, which is one of my favourite Hitchcock movies, in the sense of, you know, it's filmed in London, it's about a gang up to something nefarious, there's innocence involved, that sort of, for some reason it just really reminded me a lot of it. And there's, you know, a great climactic finale at the end. It's definitely not the best one I've seen, but I... It's not the worst. Even if the plot's, like, quite chewy, I can still enjoy it more.
I would agree with that. Yeah, like, it needed another rewrite. I don't know how this would have worked as a play. I don't know how it could have worked better. Like, I don't know how they would have changed it. Like, you can't have a train chase sequence like that in a play. You know, so, you know, like... I would like to see the play adaptation and see how it works.
I mean, I suspect the train sequence was just something for the film. I wouldn't be surprised if the end of it is just, like, some kind of shootout in the... You know, if they stage it, so it's basically just a dilapidated house, and that's how then they can get, like, you know, so-and-so falling through the roof and, you know, shooting and all that sort of thing. I wouldn't be surprised if that's how they do it. And they just have the final sequence then is just, you know, trying to get the MacGuffin, trying to get all that sort of thing, and then the train was just, let's move it outside. But yeah, no, I'd be interested to sort of see how it works as a play.
Mm-hmm. Tom, do you have any thoughts on it?
I'm just glad that you guys were here to help me figure out the movie.
Well,
I should have phoned you earlier. Yeah, it was interesting. It was, you know, I think, are we getting really burnt out on the old films? You know, like, we've really been shoveling through the coal for a while now, and I think we're very anxious to get to the modern films of Hitchcock's. And this is, again, one of those films that back in the day, people probably would have enjoyed it because they really didn't know any better. And
Shame on them. They didn't know any better.
It was hard. It was a hard film to watch. But, I, you know, like you said, the train sequence, the chases on the roof of the train and all that were pretty entertaining. It was their version of a car chase back in the day, right? Yeah. And... Right. In modern times, unless you're Chris Haig living in the UK and taking trains everywhere, we don't really experience trains. So that's a nice historical flashback.
I really don't take trains everywhere, but...
Why not?
Because I live 15 minutes from work, so I just get the bus.
No. The trains are more romantic.
Oh, yeah, listen, I love travelling by train, and Tom's alluding to... I took the train on the Friday, and a few months ago I was on a work conference train, and it was about 3 or 4 hours, and I was sat next to a woman who, I swear to God, she was reading Patricia Highsmith, who wrote it, Strangers on a Train, and I just, it annoys me to this day that I wasn't brave enough to turn to her and go, so are we killing your husband now, or... Are you going to
Hello.
You're just be like, oh, are you killing my wife? Just, and I knew it would have freaked her out. I know she would have been, oh, she would have been like, oh, yeah, very fun. I would have been like, oh, okay. But I still wanted to do it.
I picture you in the police station explaining it to them later in the day.
Yeah. Oh, I'd have been there like, no, it's a joke. And they're like, really? And I'm like, yes.
Not killing anyone. Ha ha.
Yeah. I'm like, listen, I'm not trying to kill anyone. That's what a killer would say. Fair point.
Christopher, what is your rating on this film out of 5?
Oh, 3 deaf mute girls who aren't really deaf or mute.
Legit.
Very. Brandon, out of 5.
I gave this 1.5 pretending to be knocked unconscious.
My rating will be 2. Why does everyone have a dirty hanky?
Oh, yeah.
Why does that guy have a sausage in his pocket? Yuck.
Eat it, damn it. Like, don't... Anyway.
Did you not... Okay, so later on when they pulled it out, that was clearly dough.
Yeah.
Raimi.
Like, the second time they pull it out and, like, the cop is looking at it, you can clearly tell that's, like, a rolled-up thing of dough. And it's like, he's like, oh, this is my sausage. And it's... I don't know. They probably were like, who wants a stinky sausage? Let's just throw some dough in this guy's pocket.
How dare you? It's a well-known tradition in the UK to roll up some dough.
Oh, yes, the dough sausage. Yes, yeah, dough sausage. I forgot all about the British dough sausage.
He's got a sausage in his pocket. Anyway.
Is that a sausage in your pocket? Are you just happy to see me?
Neither.
Governor? What is a governor? Why does he get any? Anyway.
I thought you were genuinely asking that.
Like a choo-choo train, we're getting sidetracked.
Like that train, we are off the tracks.
We're off the rails.
About to burst into flames.
Christopher.
Yes.
Chris, yeah. Where can people find you when you're not trying to decide whether or not to eat that sausage you found in your pocket next to your hanky?
I can never do this. You guys make me laugh. Where?
Breathe. Take a breath.
I'm mentally giving you such one-fingered salutes.
I love it.
Okay, we'll come back to Chris.
Go for it.
Brandon, where can people find you? Hey, have you done any Star Trek podcasting lately?
Tell us a bit about
what was your experience like in Vulcan, Alberta this summer? You went and did appearance at the Star Trek convention there. How did that go?
I had a heck of a lot of fun in Vulcan, Alberta. I have released an episode on Warp 5 all about it. We met some great celebrities there. We met some wonderful fans. And I'm really hoping to go back next year as well, because it's a really cool little town. As far as my Star Trek talk, you can find me on Trek FM with Warp 5, which is all about Star Trek Enterprise, with my good friends Brandy and Patrick. And you can find me on my own little show called Melodic Treks, which is all about the music of Star Trek. You can find me over on the Fandom Podcast Network with... that's us! You can find me over on the Talk Film Society podcast with my friend Zach Moore, and we're doing a Halloween podcast. And as of this recording, episode 6 has dropped. We've got 8 recorded. We got 3 more to record, and I haven't quite got to watch the Rob Zombie ones yet, so I'm looking forward to revisiting those. I've only seen them once each, so I'm really looking forward to checking those out again. And you can find me over on Cinematic Sound Radio Network with my show Breaking the Waves, which is all about electronic film scores. And I don't know if it's out yet. I've recorded it. I'm not sure when it's going to be released, but my second episode is all about 4 film scores by Tangerine Dream. So it's a cool little episode. Yeah, I like that. It's a lot of fun. Excellent. Chris, where can people find you when you're not folding up your sausage?
Stop it. I'm genuinely trying to do this now.
Don't provoke him.
I hate you guys so much. When I'm not accidentally coercing a woman to help me kill her husband, which may or may not be a thing on British trains, you can find me on Twitter at @Hyatt_boy. When I'm not discussing folding sausages with these two Canadian reprobates, I'm also a co-host on North by Nerd West, which is a great podcast that me and my best mate Emma Platt do. We've taken the summer off, and we're hoping to get some new episodes out. Maybe at the time of this airing we have done one, which would be great. If not, I also co-host or appear on a lot of different podcasts such as Smorgasbord, Eccentric Earth, which is Amy Walker's fantastic weird and cool history podcast, and a few others.
Tom, where can people find you when you're not fishing necklaces out of toilets?
I am the Tom Caldwell on Instagram. I am also Tom Caldwell 3000 on Twitter. And thank you again to everybody that's been participating in our Twitter and Facebook getting involved and talking and commenting. And we're getting quite a loyal following. We really appreciate the regular listeners. And hopefully we can do as much as we can to grow the family and get lots of more people involved with our little podcast that could.
Aww.
So thanks very much again to the Fandom Podcast Network for hosting our show. We really appreciate it. We are in their master feed as well as in our own independent feed. You can find our good friends Annie and Catherine if you're looking for some more Hitchcock coverage. They've got a show called Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock Presents podcast. They're going through all of Alfred Hitchcock Presents one episode at a time in kind of random order. And thank you so much to our good friend Jason Cullimore for his amazing theme song that he's created for our show. It's wonderful. We love it, and we feel so professional now that we've got some great sound and music that's all our own.
Thank you, gentlemen, for being here. It's been great getting back in the studio, and I wish you a good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.